The middle chapter for this unit is more specifically about DNA than the previous one was. And DNA is a household term nowadays. It's the most famous large molecule. I mean, I guess you could say water is more famous than DNA, but people all over the world know about DNA nowadays. It hasn't been all that long, though, that we've really known very much about DNA. And so I'm going to give you a couple of important historical experiments, starting with slide one. Now, not only do people know about DNA, whether they've ever had a biology course or not, most people also know that DNA is somehow involved in inheritance. They might not know molecularly how it works, but they know that it's a molecule of inheritance. Well, for much longer than we've known DNA as a molecule of inheritance, we've known about inheritance in general, right? For thousands of years, humans have recognized that not only humans, but other organisms have inheritance. In other words, parents pass off traits to their offspring, whatever the species is. We've known this for a hell of a long time, and we've wondered for a hell of a long time how that happens. Thousands of years, like I said. But it wasn't until recently that we've demonstrated that there is a particle of inheritance, as opposed to, for instance, just some mysterious force that causes this. It was reasonable long ago to assume that, you know, once we started learning that there is a whole microscopic world and things are made out of molecules and so on, it was reasonable to assume that there is some sort of chemical basis for inheritance. But just like I was talking about before for the cell cycle, you can't just say, well, this makes sense, so let's believe it. You have to demonstrate it. In slide one, we're looking at an experiment, the Griffith experiment. That's what it's called. You don't have to remember the experimenter's name. But in his lab, they did this experiment, which was the first to... The reason it's historically important is it's the first to demonstrate a molecular basis for inheritance. What's happening here is that there are several controls here. They were investigating what happens to mice, non-volunteer mice that were infected intentionally with bacteria that cause pneumonia. And there are two strains of this bacterium. They're the so-called S strain and the R strain. Now, the S, that's the same species, but there are two different strains. And the S version is virulent, which means it's the dangerous stuff. It causes the pneumonia, which kills the mouse. The R strain, on the other hand, does not cause pneumonia. And so it's relatively harmless. Okay? Huge difference. Same species, but which strain you get makes a big difference. Well, these first controls, two controls, make perfect sense. If you take living S cells, the dangerous ones, and inject them into healthy mice, the mice will die. If you give healthy mice living R cells, which are the harmless ones, not surprisingly, they won't die. So no surprises there. They're just experimental controls. The third control, also a control, is one in which they started with S cells, the dangerous ones, but before injecting them, they killed them with heat. They boiled them. So no living cells were injected, and not surprisingly, even though it's the dangerous kind, when they're dead, they don't cause pneumonia in the mice, and they lived. Then in the fourth one, which is the most important one, what they did was start with heat-killed S1s again, which are the harmful ones, but they're dead. And then they mixed those dead S cells with living, harmless R cells. And then they injected that mixture into the mice, and surprisingly, they died. So you have harmless cells and dead harmful cells, and that somehow killed the mouse. What actually is happening here, what they were demonstrating for the first time, was what's called bacterial transformation. And they didn't know the details of how this worked at the time, but that's what it is called. Bacterial transformation is one way that cells can change their DNA. Certain bacteria, if the conditions are just right, can take up naked DNA from the environment. Naked DNA is DNA that's no longer in a cell. It's still a molecule. It was in a cell originally, but that cell is dead, has burst, and now it's just naked DNA in the environment. So a bacteria can take up DNA that happens to be around them, even though it's not from their species even. It could be just DNA from some other organism that has died, and under the right circumstances can take that DNA into their cell and start using it along with, add it to their DNA library and start using it like it's always been their own DNA. And that's what happened here. The R cells were transformed by taking up DNA from the dead S cells, naked DNA. And that turned or transformed those R cells into the S variety. They now had brand new traits that they didn't have before because they have new DNA. And that's exactly why the mice died. It wasn't that the dead S cells were brought back to life. New S cells were created when R's were transformed. So transformation is the specific mechanism here, but the importance historically of the experiment is that they showed for the first time there is a material basis for inheritance, because these cells, their traits, the trait of being dangerous, was acquired by acquiring some material. Now, they didn't know at the time what that material was, but this showed a material basis, an inheritance particle, in other words. And naturally, the next question is, well, what's this particle? They didn't solve that. They just showed this. Well, in two, I'll be talking about another experiment, but what's that?
Bacterial phages.
Yes. I'm going to talk about another important experiment involving these bacteriophages. But first, let me say that once you've shown that there is a particle of inheritance, that, like I said, the next question is, what is it? Well, you can make guesses, because if you just blindly go trying to test every possible molecule in the world, it's going to take forever, right? So you try to make logical guesses to narrow down your work. And, you know, they did things like saying, well, it's very likely not water, or very simple molecules like that. I just, it's probably going to be a macromolecule.
Yeah. But most likely not glucose.
Well, glucose isn't even a macromolecule.
Fair enough.
So they narrowed it down to only big molecules, because the reasoning here is it's a particle of inheritance must be a complex thing. Therefore, it's one of the big four that we talked about. And then they narrowed it down further and they said, well, it probably is not lipids. They're not as complex, and we kind of know what lipids do already. So not that it was impossible, but they said, let's not start there. They also said it's probably not polysaccharides. Those are pretty well known, what they do, and they're not all that complex. They can be huge, but not really all that complex in their makeup. So that's not very likely either. And that leaves two, right? The two that's left over are polypeptides, or proteins, and nucleic acids, or polynucleotides. Well, at that time, more Most of the biologists guessed that it was probably proteins. And the reason they guessed that, which was a reasonable guess, is that proteins, compared to all the other kinds of macromolecules, as we've discussed, have really no limit to their complexity. They can be as complex as you need them to be if you were designing them. And so they said, well, something that is going to control something as complex as inheritance must itself be a very complex molecule. So they said, I'm betting on proteins, but we have to demonstrate it. Nucleic acids were kept in the mix, though, as a contender, mostly because at that point, even though we knew they existed as macromolecules, we really didn't know what they did. So they said, well, since we don't know anything else that they do, maybe let's just include those too. And that brings us to this experiment, which, as you said, involves bacteriophages. The bacteriophages are these three green things that look like Hollywood versions of aliens. A bacteriophage, importantly, is not a bacterium.
Is it a virus?
Yes, a bacteriophage is a virus, specifically one that invades bacteria. And the phage part of that, like in phagocytosis, means eat. Well, a bacteriophage does not actually eat a bacterium, but the bacterium does die in the process, usually, which is why they're called that. Okay, so bacteriophages are shown here. There's three of them. And a much, much larger bacterium, as small as a bacterium is, it's huge compared to a virus, is just part of it is shown here. In brown. Now, why did they choose to use bacteriophages for this experiment? Well, because specifically a bacteriophage, is made up of exactly the two things that they're trying to test. First of all, a virus is not an organism. Why is that true? Right? And why can't it have a metabolism? Structurally, what does it lack? It not only lacks a nucleus, but a bacterium does as well, and it's also an organism.
Is it a prokaryote?
It is not even an organism. Why? What do you have to have to be an organism?
A whole bunch of things. You know, half of them, basically, viruses don't do.
Yeah, you're talking about that first slide I ever showed you. That's true of living things. But structurally speaking, the bare minimum requirement for being an organism is that you have to have at least one cell. That's where metabolism occurs, in cells. Well, viruses aren't even close to having a cell. A virus is really just a collection of molecules. And in the simplest ones, like bacteriophages, they are just a nucleic acid, either DNA or RNA, in this case DNA, wrapped in a protein coat. So it's part, it's just two macromolecules, a DNA and a protein. But that's exactly the two things that they narrowed this down to. And what you can see here is that when a bacterium gets infected, what that means is that a virus has attached to it, a bacteriophage has attached to its surface. And when that occurs, there is an injection of material from the bacteriophage into the bacterium. Now, you already know the answer. What gets injected is the DNA part of the bacterium, not the protein part. But they didn't know that then. That's why they set the experiment up. If we're narrowing it down to these two macromolecules, and that's all there is in a bacteriophage, and one of those two things gets injected, causing a change in the bacterium, then let's narrow it down and find out which one of those two things does get injected. That's the purpose of this experiment. Because whatever it is that does get injected is the genetic material. Well, we can look at how they did this in slide 3. They used two colonies of bacteria grown in solution, or actually suspension, I should say. A suspension is cells surrounded by liquid. Both of these batches used what is called radio labeling. They needed to be able to keep track separately of the two macromolecules that the viruses are made out of. They need to be able to tell where the protein is and where the nucleic acid is at all times. And to do that, they used radio labeling, meaning subjecting these viruses, or growing them up in a sense, creating new viruses in an environment in which the only available materials were radioactive materials. Radioactive materials are able to be detected experimentally. You can tell where the radiation is, and therefore you can tell where those materials are. So in one of these batches, the pink one, they made trillions and trillions of copies of new viruses in an environment that contained radioactive sulfur, S35. Now, this is a good choice. There's all kinds of radioactive elements, but radioactive sulfur was a good choice for this because sulfur is a component of some proteins, of some amino acids, I should say. Remember, there's 20 biological amino acids. There's sulfur in cysteine, which is one of the 20. And therefore, there's going to be sulfur in proteins. Any proteins that contain cysteine are going to be sulfur-containing as well. But there is no sulfur, as you already have learned, in nucleotides. And therefore, DNA doesn't contain any sulfur because it's made up of nucleotides. So this is by choosing sulfur, in other words, they were able to label just the protein without labeling the DNA. In the blue batch, it was the reverse. They chose radioactive phosphorus, P32, for a similar reason. Even though there are some amino acids that contain phosphorus, it's not nearly as much as is contained in nucleic acids. Because the DNA, which is however many thousands or millions of nucleotides long, every single nucleotide has phosphate in it, right, as one of the three components. So DNA is going to be chock full of phosphorus, and when the only phosphorus available to make new viruses is radioactive, that means all the new viruses get labeled with radioactivity. All right, they kept these batches separate, and then they infected bacteria in each batch. Just let the viruses attach and infect. Then they needed to use a perfect tool to separate what was left behind, the empty shell of the virus, from the bacterium that now includes what was injected into it. And they needed to do this by mixing the suspension rapidly enough so that you could break apart these empty shells, but not stir it so vigorously that it will explode the living bacteria that were infected. And it just turned out that the perfect thing for the job was an ordinary bar blender, which they used. So you put them in a bar blender, and that dislodges these empty shells, keeps the bacteria intact, okay, for both batches. Then they subjected the suspensions to centrifugation, put them in tubes and spun them. When you spin in a centrifuge, you produce G-forces. So you just drastically speed up the dropping of heavy things in that suspension. The heaviest stuff goes to the bottom. That's the pellet. Everything that's lighter floats above that. That's the supernatant. All right. Well, in the pink batch, and by the way, in both batches, the heaviest things by far are the bacterial cells. They're much bigger than individual molecules in suspension. So the pellet included the cells in both batches. But in the pink batch, which labeled only the proteins, they found no radioactivity in the pellets. They found all the radioactivity in the supernatant, meaning the shells contained the protein. Just the opposite for the blue batch. Radioactivity in the pellet, and that shows that it was the DNA, not the protein, that was injected into those cells. The shells weren't labeled in this one. They were the proteins. So that's a very well-designed experiment to definitively narrow it down between these two. And it was the first time that they showed that DNA is the the molecule of heredity. But as definitive as it is, seems obvious now, in hindsight, there were a lot of skeptical biologists because, like I said, they first guessed it's protein because it must be a very complex molecule. And so there were some biologists at the time who said, okay, well, yes, this shows that DNA is the molecule of inheritance for bacteria, a simple organism. But for something very complex like a human, it must be proteins. Well, they eventually came around, and DNA is the inheritance molecule for all organisms, not just simple bacteria. Okay, well, let's take a closer look at DNA. We've done this a little bit before. This is a tiny, tiny piece of DNA because it's only 4 nucleotides long. A chromosome, a single chromosome, like we were talking about in the previous chapter, is millions of nucleotides long. The reason 4 are shown here, just as a little snippet, is to remind you of the fact that there are 4 different kinds of DNA nucleotides that can be used in any combination. And the reason that there are 4 different kinds of nucleotides is only because of the one of the 3 parts of the nucleotides. Remember that any single nucleotide contains a pentose sugar, 5-carbon sugar, to which is attached a phosphate and also a nitrogenous base. Well, for DNA, the sugar is always deoxyribose, so that's no variability. Phosphates are all identical, so that's not variability. Therefore, the only reason there are different kinds of nucleotides is because the nitrogenous base that's connected to them can be different. And there are 4 that DNA normally uses. Adenine, thymine, guanine, cytosine, or A, T, C, and G, as you see them in abbreviations. That should be review at this point. But also review, hopefully you remember this, is that when you use individual nucleotides as monomers and hook them together to build a polymer, which in this case would be a polynucleotide, a nucleic acid, like DNA, there's only one way that you can hook them together. Just like there was only one way you can hook together amino acids to build a polypeptide, right? Amino group to carboxyl group. That's the only way. Well, the way that you build, the way that you hook 2 nucleotides together in DNA is to hook the phosphate of one nucleotide to the sugar of the next nucleotide. And then its phosphate will be hooked to the sugar of the next nucleotide, and so on down the line for however many there are. So it's sugar, phosphate, over and over. And that alone, each of those is a covalent bond, but those connections between sugar and phosphate of adjacent nucleotides, that's the only thing that is holding this overall strand, however long it is, together along its length. It's the only thing that makes it a polypeptide. Otherwise, it would be individual nucleotides. I'm sorry, not a polypeptide, a polynucleotide. All right, now, that's why we call just that part of it, the sugar and the phosphates combined, that's why we call that the sugar-phosphate backbone. The sugar-phosphate backbone is really important because DNA is an informational molecule. The reason that it has information is because it has a specific sequence with respect to its nitrogenous bases. The code, or the information in the molecule, is the particular sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's, which can be anything. But for any given DNA, it's a specific thing, right? Well, if all you have is a bunch of letters, you have no idea what a sentence is. You know, if you don't do typesetting anymore, but do you know what I mean by typesetting? When they used to prepare newspapers, they had to do it one letter at a time with little metal stamps, basically. So they would assemble sentences out of letters. If you drop that thing before you get it to the press, you're probably fired because now you just have a pile of letters. You have no idea what that information is. Similarly, if you break this chain into individual nucleotides, then you don't have that information anymore. So it's really important for the thing holding these polynucleotide together along its length to be strong, which is why these are covalent bonds, the strongest of the bond types. That's the sugar phosphate backbone. And notice that the nitrogenous bases are not at all involved in holding this thing together. They are hanging off of the sugar phosphate backbone individually, and they're not attached to each other either. This is completely analogous to the R groups of a polypeptide. The only thing holding together a polypeptide along its length are the amino and carboxyl groups. The R groups, the variable part of the amino acids, are just hanging off of that chain, not interacting with each other. Okay? Similar situation here. Well, what we have pictured here, however long it is, it's not just four. That's why it fades. The blue fades at the top and bottom to show you it's actually longer. But however long it is, that's a single strand of DNA. And DNA, as opposed to RNA, usually does not occur as a single strand. Normal DNA is a double strand, which means there's two separate polynucleotides, just like this one. And remember, each individual polynucleotide, however long it is a complete molecule, really. So what we call one DNA is really two polynucleotides, two complete molecules that are then held together, not by chemical bonds. If they were chemical bonds, then you wouldn't have two separate molecules still, right? You'd be forming one doubly big molecule instead. Well, that's not what happens. In a DNA, both of the strands are kept as separate polynucleotides, but they're held comparatively loosely together by hydrogen bonds, as you said. That's just as important as using covalent bonds for the sugar phosphate backbone. Hydrogen bonds are weak, as you've already known, right? They're not chemical bonds even. They're not strong enough to form new stuff. So being weak, they're very easy to break. That's really important, though, because the two strands of DNA that are held together need to be weak enough so that you can temporarily separate the two strands to do either of the two major functions of DNA. What are those major functions? Transcription is one, and replication, exactly. If you need to do either one of those, you have to start by reading the code in a strand. And you can't read the code when it's hooked to the other strand. You have to be able to separate the two, and that's easy to do when the thing that's holding them together are hydrogen bonds. Okay? Let's go on to five. A little bit more historical importance here. This is Rosalind Franklin, who died of cancer when she was young, but she also, unfortunately, died really before she had time to realize she would eventually be given the credit she deserves. Now she's pretty famous, but for a long time, because of sexism mostly, her name wasn't really known, even though she was really important in the elucidation of the structure of DNA. Watson and Crick got the Nobel Prize. Do you know those names? Are those still famous? Okay. They were men. That's why they got famous immediately. But she really helped them. I'm not saying Watson and Crick didn't do important stuff. They were important too. But they got pretty much all the credit. She was also important, though, because Watson and Crick knew what the components were. Their job, or what their goal was to put them together and figure out the actual shape of DNA. Because now that we're at the point in the history where DNA has already been shown to be the molecule of inheritance, then the big question is, how does it work? But you can't skip to right to how does it work, even though you want to, without knowing how is it shaped, because knowing the shape can help you figure out how it works. So the next big question was, what is the structure of DNA? Watson and Crick, along with Rosalind Franklin, figured this out. Her reason she was a good person to consult on this is because she was a world expert on a technique called X-ray crystallography. Crystallography is a general technique to figure out the shapes of molecules based on diffraction patterns. Diffraction is the bending of light when it encounters something, like an edge of something. It'll go off in a new direction. Well, X-rays are just light, invisible to us, but they're still light. And if you use X-ray film, just like on X-rays, medically speaking, on the other end, and you shine X-rays onto whatever kind of molecule that you don't know the shape of, it will get bent in different directions depending on the shape. This is a famous photograph of an X-ray diffraction pattern that doesn't look like much to us, but Franklin knew enough about the technique that she said, this to me looks like it could be helical in shape. And that's really what Watson and Crick took the advice of and started tinkering around with their tin model. You've probably seen a historic photo of the first model they ever built of DNA. It's about this big. They figured out, yeah, this does work as a helix, specifically a double helix, because there's two strands in a DNA. Each individual strand is one helix, but you also have the other one along with it. And that's what Franklin contributed. So let's look at this helix in slide 6, this double helix. We see, once again, just a little bit of the overall length of a double helical DNA. This is one DNA, but as I said, it's really two molecules because each strand is its own polynucleotide. And the ribbons here in blue represent the sugar phosphate backbone. That's what keeps each strand together along its length. The nitrogenous bases are shown as just A's, T's, C's, and G's hanging off of each backbone. And a pair of nitrogenous bases, one from each of the two backbones, one from each of the two strands, make up what kind of look like a half of a step in an overall spiral staircase. Or, more simply than a staircase, it looks like it's a twisted ladder. Right? The whole molecule looks like it's a twisted ladder, where a pair of nitrogenous bases form one rung of the ladder. And if you just mentally untwist the ladder to make it into a regular ladder, a straight ladder, you have what's shown in the middle. Well, I don't remember how much detail I gave you on this when we first looked at DNA, but let's go over it either for the first or second time. The two sugar phosphate backbones, which are the, what are the vertical parts of a ladder called? Styles? I don't actually. Vertical parts of the ladder. Those are the sugar phosphate backbones. They, each individual one has polarity, meaning there are two different ends. And you kind of got an idea of this when you played around with the puzzles. Actually, it's true for any number of nucleotides, including just one nucleotide. The carbons are numbered. There's five of them in the sugar, right? But there's a carbon 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Well, only the first four are part of the ring because oxygen is the fifth member of the ring. It's not carbon. But starting clockwise from the oxygen, the first carbon, remember, every corner that is not labeled with something else is a C, a carbon. This is first, second, third, fourth, and then the fifth one is hanging off. An individual nucleotide has a 3' end and a 5' end. But when you hook it together any number of nucleotides more than one, the whole strand also has a 3' end and a 5' end. The 3' end is the part that is associated with the third carbon of the sugar. And the 3' end has a hydroxyl, Remember OH? The 5' prime end, this carbon, has the phosphate hooked to it, whether it's a single nucleotide or a whole strand. So that's why a polynucleotide has polarity. There's a 5' prime end with a phosphate, and there's a 3' prime end with a hydroxyl. Well, as we've already been talking about, an entire DNA, a double strand, has 2 polynucleotides, but they're not arranged with their ends similar. They're arranged in what's called an anti-parallel arrangement. Anti-parallel refers to the fact that the 5' prime end of one strand is right next to the 3' prime end of the other strand, and vice versa. So instead of it being head-to-head and tail-to-tail, it's head-to-tail arrangement. That forms the vertical parts of the ladder. Each rung of the ladder is a pair of nitrogenous bases, that are hanging off of that backbone. And as we were talking about a little bit before, the two strands are held together without actually becoming one big molecule. They're still separate molecules, but they're held together by hydrogen bonds that occur between the nitrogenous bases at the same position but on opposite strands. That's what the magenta-colored ellipses are, hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bond individually is tiny, which is good because it's easily broken. When you want to read this thing, you need to separate these two strands from each other. But when you're talking about millions of them, because these strands are made up of millions of nucleotides, they add up to a lot of force that holds them together nicely when you're not intentionally separating them to read them. Okay, let's go on to 7. Now I remember that I did tell you about purines and pyrimidines because I remember telling you that I could never keep track of which one was which until I realized that the word pyrimidine has a Y in it, and so do the words cytosine and thymine. Remember that mnemonic trick I gave you? There are two, although there are 4 overall DNA nitrogenous bases, they exist in 2 categories, purines and pyrimidines. And purines, as you see, are double-ringed nitrogenous bases. Pyrimidines are single-ringed. So the pyrimidines, in other words, aren't as big in terms of how much space they fill as purines are. Well, this brings us to another historical figure, a guy called Chargaff, who extensively studied DNA at this time when we were first learning about it, and developed what are called Chargaff's rules. What he did was just study DNA from an enormous variety of organisms. All kinds of things, plants, bacteria, humans, blah, blah, blah. And what he noticed is that no matter what organism, what species he took the DNA out of, when he chemically tested it, by which I mean chemically determine how much of these purines and pyrimidines there are in there, he noticed that irrespective of the species, there was always as much purine as there was pyrimidine. Totally different DNA sequences. Well, he didn't know about DNA sequences, but totally different DNA. Always, though, an equal amount of purine and pyrimidine. And that's what Chargaff's rule is. There's an equal amount of the two. Well, this slide 7 kind of shows you why that is true. If you're building this ladder, which is, it's really a twisted ladder, but think about building it as an untwisted ladder. You want to build an ordinary ladder that has the same distance apart, the same width of rungs all along the length of the ladder. But each rung, remember, is made up of a nitrogenous base from one side and a nitrogenous base from the other side. If you had purine with purine forming one rung, because they are wider, that would make a wide rung. If you matched up pyrimidine with pyrimidine, it would be a narrow rung. And so that would make a zigzag ladder. But if you always matched up a purine with a pyrimidine, it wouldn't matter which one is in which place, right or left, you would still always have the same width rung, just like a normal ladder. And that explains what Chargaff observed. There's always as much purine as pyrimidine because wherever you have a purine in one strand, you're going to have a pyrimidine in the other strand at that same position. Does that make sense? Well, that explains partly an important part of DNA. I haven't gotten quite to 8 yet. But in addition to all the other important things we've been talking about as far as DNA is concerned, anti-parallel and whatever, it's important to note that DNA also has complementarity. That's the noun. We can say it's complementary. This is complementary with an E, not an I. Not complementary in the sense of saying you have a nice dress. It's E here. Complementary means kind of like reciprocal or opposite. Or for instance, my shoes. I have a complementary pair of these at home where the left one is this one, this right one, and so on. That's what complementary means. So purine always with pyrimidine is part of complementarity. But it's actually more strict than that. The complementarity of DNA is more strict than that. It's not simply any purine with any pyrimidine. It is specifically, as you see in 8, adenine always with thymine. Adenine is a purine, thymine is a pyrimidine, but it's always specifically adenine with specifically thymine, and it's always specifically guanine with specifically cytosine. So A and T go together, C and G go together. It doesn't matter which one's on right or left, but it's always A with T, it's always C with G. That's more stringent than just saying purine with pyrimidine, because just purine with pyrimidine would allow for guanine and thymine, right? That doesn't happen, though. Well, they would be the right width for the ladder if you did that, but this shows you why it doesn't happen. Adenine and thymine both are able to make 2 hydrogen bonds, so they match up perfectly. Cytosine and guanine can both make 3 hydrogen bonds, and so they match up perfectly. And that's why it evolved that way. Now, the importance of this strict complementarity can't be overstated, because this is why DNA can work for self-replication. And in fact, when Watson and Crick published their paper, which the purpose of the paper was just to say this is the structure of DNA, it wasn't at all about how it works. The last sentence was, we notice that this complementarity could be a way for DNA to have the capability of replicating itself. It was a huge understatement. That was an important way to end the paper, because it was exactly true. Because of strict complementarity, whatever you have as a sequence in one strand, you have an exactly complementary sequence in the other strand. And the reason that can be used for DNA replication, which has to be an exact copy, is that you can separate the 2 strands and read just one of the sequences, and because of complementarity rules, A always with T and C always with G, whatever that sequence that you're reading is, you know what the complementary sequence must be. And therefore, if you build that, you're making new DNA that's exact, an exact copy. And we'll be looking at that in the rest of the chapter. In fact, right now. Slide 9 shows you what I was just saying in a paragraph. In this book, the book that these slides come from, the author uses dark blue to represent DNA from the previous generation, the older DNA, the DNA that exists already, and light blue to represent brand new DNA that's being created. So we have the parent molecule of DNA here, or just a little bit of its sequence. And you can see the strict complementarity. Wherever you have a G, there's a C in the other place. Wherever you have a T, there's an A. It's always A with T, always C with G. Well, because of that strict complementarity, like I was saying, you can separate these two strands, like was done in B here, and you could completely hide one of these from me. And I can, if as long as I'm allowed to read the other one, I can tell you exactly what the sequence is in the other. Because all I have to do is say, this is a C, well, the other one must be a G. This is a T, well, the other one has to be an A, and so on for the entire length. That's why DNA can self-replicate. Because of strict complementarity, each individual strand of the two that are in DNA can serve by itself as a template for how to build a copy of the other one that's been removed from it. And if that's done individually for each of the two original strands, which is here, and you make a new complementary strand complementary to each of those two originals, then what you have at the end of that process is two complete double helical DNAs that are identical to each other and to the original DNA. That's exactly what DNA replication has to accomplish, right? It's not enough to just make new DNA. You have to make an exact copy of the existing DNA so that both of the two cells that the cell splits into will have a complete proper library of DNA that's the same as the original cell and the same as each other. Ten is a listing of three possibilities how this could happen. This is just a logically exhaustive list, meaning one of these has to be true. There is the so-called conservative model of DNA replication, the semi-conservative model, and the dispersive model. Now, what's happening in all three of these is that you're making new DNA by reading old DNA. And so the result is going to be some combination of older dark blue DNA and newer light blue DNA, right? But there's three ways it could happen. The conservative model is called that because the original DNA, both strands of it, gets conserved or saved. So you read the code, and you make a brand new, totally brand new double-stranded DNA, and the original double-stranded DNA is still there. That's what conservative means in this case. Okay, that could happen. That's one possibility. Semi-conservative means you separate the two, read each strand separately, and you build a brand new strand that is now bonded to that one old strand, and you do the same thing for the other old strand. So that forms two double helices, but each one is one old strand and one new strand. That's semi-conservative, half-saved. Well, the only other possibility, logically, is the so-called dispersive model, which also happens to be the most complex, and therefore, just for that reason alone, the least likely. Things that are more complex are less likely to happen, but it's mathematically a possible mechanism, dispersive model. In the dispersive model, each of the two original strands gets broken into bits, and each bit serves as a code for making a corresponding new bit, and then they're all sewn together. So in each double helix, each individual strand is partly old and partly new. That's the least likely to be true, but you have to consider it since it's a possibility. That, of course, then brings up the question of which of these is actually true. So what they did in slide 11, which is another experiment, is try to narrow it down between these three, which one is actually true. And they used labeling again here, but instead of radioactive elements, they used isotopes, heavy nitrogen. Remember, isotopes are the same element, but with a different number of neutrons, and therefore they have more mass or less mass, depending on the isotope. Well, the reason they wanted to use different masses is so that they could figure out where they are based on centrifugation. The heavier something is, the farther it goes down in the tube. And so they labeled these things, the DNA that were in cells, of course, let the cells replicate many times, creating new stuff. And if the conservative model were true, then you would have some completely old DNA, both strands old, and some completely new. And therefore, you should see two bands in the centrifuge, a heavier one at the bottom and a lighter one at the top. Well, they didn't see that, so immediately they proved that conservative is wrong. They saw only one band, because it's half new and half old. Okay? But notice that the dispersive model and the semi-conservative model both predict there to be DNAs that are half old and half new, but in different ways. So they both would result in one layer. You can't tell you can't tell which of these is true just by one round of replication. That's why they did it again, let them do another generation. And in the second generation, notice that the dispersive model would continue to predict only one band. It would just get lighter and lighter because it would contain less and less old material. But the semi-conservative model for the second replication involves two bands because these two are completely new, these two are half and half. And that's exactly what they saw. So another well-designed experiment to show that actual DNA replication, even though there's three possibilities, real DNA replication occurs by a semi-conservative model. Let us adjourn.